Hello and welcome to Inside Europe, the weekly current affairs podcast and radio programme from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. I'm Kate Laycock in Bonn. This week on the show, a Frenchman in New York, 24 hours in the life of Emmanuel Macron. Defending NATO airspace, just how far is the alliance prepared to go? And small country, global stakes, why you should care about the Moldovan elections.
The victory of pro-Russian forces would also affect the security of the whole region and the security of NATO's eastern flank. It's not about one small country, one small Soviet republic. It's about the whole region and also about the war in Ukraine.
All those stories and more right here on Inside Europe. It has been a difficult week for European leaders. Russian incursions in the skies and on the ground in New York, this.
Both the immigration and their suicidal energy ideas will be the death of Western Europe. Your countries are going to hell.
The President of the United States there with that literally damning verdict on life in Europe. If that was friendly fire, then the stony faces of the European leaders assembled at the UN General Assembly suggested that the friendliness was rather lost on them. Still, there is one European leader who, when in a jam, still does not hesitate to pick up the phone to Donald Trump, as was gloriously demonstrated just a few hours after the president's unscripted address to the UN, when Francis Emmanuel Macron used his personal hotline to complain about the traffic. A case for our Paris correspondent turned political sketch writer, John Laurenson.
If you don't see it,
we're so lucky that a reporter from the French online media Brut, Raw in English, was there to film this because it was an extraordinary scene. The President of France, who has got out of his vehicle to go and talk to police because traffic's been halted in anticipation of the passage of President Trump's motorcade.
Now, I have 10 people with me. I go to the French embassy.
Sorry, I'm President, I'm really sorry. It's just that everything's in frozen right now. There's a border kick coming away. That's
all. If you don't see it, let me cross. I negotiate with you.
But the Macron negotiating skills that persuaded so many countries to join France in recognising a Palestinian state failed to move the New York Police Department. So the French head of state took out his cell phone and called Donald. And the leader of the free world picked up.
How are you? Guess what? I'm waiting in the street because everything is frozen for you.
Then, not wanting to let such a good opportunity to bring peace and security to the Middle East go to waste, Macron followed up with this.
But you know, after I would love if you can have a short discussion with Qatar and you from the situation in Gaza because...
Whether it was thanks to a breakthrough in negotiations with the police officer or a deal struck with the great dealmaker himself, the next we see on this excellent short film, Monsieur Macron has managed to cross the motorcade blockade, but he's had to abandon his vehicle. The French president, whose title confers a status usually hovering somewhere in the gold-tinged clouds between prime minister and king, had to continue his journey on foot, and so he walked, talking all along into a cell phone jammed to his ear, which kind of made it look like he was in charge of the situation. He walked and he walked, 30 minutes in all, between shoppers and people coming home from work. Occasionally someone would recognise him and ask for a selfie. One man gave him a kiss on the forehead. You had to pinch yourself to remember that this was the same man who'd stood up a few hours previously in front of the United Nations General Assembly and said this.
C'est pourquoi, fidèle à
l'engagement. The time has come, Macron said. Faithful to the historic commitment of my country to the Middle East, for peace between the Israeli people and the Palestinian people, I declare that France recognizes today the state of Palestine.
L'état de Palestine.
On that subject, Donald Trump, speaking a little earlier and very much longer and without a teleprompter because it had broken down, linked this to the Hamas attacks on Israeli civilians on October the 7th and had this to say about Macron's claim that recognition of Palestine will help bring peace.
Some of this body is seeking to unilaterally recognize a Palestinian state, the rewards would be too great for Hamas terrorists for their atrocities. This would be a reward for these horrible atrocities.
But in a wide roaming speech, astounding even by his standards, Donald Trump has also sent a number of verbal ballistic missiles in the direction of Europe, where Emmanuel Macron is arguably the most prominent leader, telling Europeans their countries were going to hell, his exact words, because of uncontrolled immigration and bad energy policy. Despite their friendly personal relations, real or feigned, there is an ideological battle being fought, a culture war, if you like, between Donald Trump and Emmanuel Macron. They do have one thing in common. They both came to power by defying the establishment parties, Macron by founding a new one, Trump with a hostile takeover bid of the Republicans. But while Trump raised the flag of the populist right, Macron's coup was for the technocratic centre. On a personal level, the differences are even more flagrant. Trump belongs to a business, not a cultural or intellectual elite. Macron hails from the professional bourgeoisie, rose through academic excellence in elite state institutions and the civil service. And ever since Macron's first visit to the Trump White House, when the American flicked a speck of imaginary dandruff off Macron's suit, saying, "We have to make him perfect. He is perfect," Trump has been trying to make the Frenchman look small, which, as the passers-by in New York may have remarked, he physically is. John Norrison, DW, Paris.
Political optics even a MAGA spin doctor could not have dreamed of there. The next day, however, brought a sobering reminder of the seriousness of the global situation.
We are now living through the most destructive arms race in human history. And if there are no real security guarantees except friends and weapons, and if the world can't respond even to all threats, and if there is no strong platform for international security, will there be any place left on Earth that's still safe for people?
On Wednesday, Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky appealed to the UN General Assembly for intervention to stop Russia and warned of the most destructive arms race in human history, one in which the combination of artificial intelligence and drone technology could end in catastrophe. The threat from drones is very real. Drone incursions into the airspace of Europe's eastern flank countries has been going on for a while. But in recent days, there has been a significant escalation. A key turning point came on September 9th with an incident which already has its own Wikipedia entry, titled 2025 Russian Drone Incursion into Poland. Our security correspondent, Terry Schultz, walked me through the significance of recent events, beginning with the shooting down of those drones over Poland.
Poland saw 19 drones at one time come in. You know, nothing compared to what Ukraine sees every night all over the country. But for this coming into NATO airspace, it was a big deal. And so because Poland is protected by NATO's air policing operation, that means that other countries also help protect the airspace in all of the frontline states. The whole effort was alerted, and Polish and Dutch jets took to the air. The Dutch were on duty. It's their rotation. And for the first time ever, they actually shot down some of the Russian drones. So of this 19, this group of 19, three were downed. And this would not have been so remarkable if it was just by the Polish planes, Kate, but the Dutch planes also shot. And that meant immediately that, okay, NATO took a stand on this. This was not just Poland protecting its national airspace. NATO was involved. And so there's been a lot of concern that this makes it look like NATO is at war with Russia. They're always concerned this, you know, would be escalatory is the key word here. But NATO has decided it's not putting up with it anymore. And so for those of us who watched the alliance closely, this was, kind of a big deal.
Okay, so a turning point. The debris on the ground means that Russia can't deny that the drones are theirs. And we have this new, more assertive response from NATO. It's not deterred Moscow, though, has it?
Hardly. But you're right. So, Russia usually denies being involved, but they could very much prove that these were Russian drones. Some of them came in from Belarus this time, which was sort of alarming to the Polish government, because that meant in their mind sort of there's a new front, and Belarus is cooperating with Russia even in this way. They've been doing that politically and militarily for a long time. But yeah, this was worrying for the Polish government. But you know, just a couple of days later, there was a Russian drone that went into Romanian airspace, and this was just a single one. So everybody was watching it, but they decided not to shoot it down, and it went back across the Romanian border into Ukraine, which isn't great. But at least on the NATO side, they decided that this did not rise to the level of wanting to shoot. But it did show that, you know, Moscow wasn't particularly worried about the response.
Indeed. And I mean, we've now got to the stage where this week, it's not just drones that we have to worry about incurring into NATO airspace.
This was really remarkable, because these planes came in and stayed in Estonia's airspace for between 10 and 12 minutes. And usually, again, these kind of little incursions happen all the time, been happening for years, where they come in for a few seconds and then they go back out. And those are worrying in themselves, because these planes generally don't use their transponders, so they don't file any flight plans. So nobody on the ground knows they're there. They're really just ripe for an accident. But in this case, staying in Estonian airspace for 10 minutes, they can hardly say that this was an accident, that they didn't know where they were, that they got off track, none of those things. They were escorted the entire time, again, by NATO jets who protect Estonian airspace, because the Baltic states don't have their own air forces. So they were flanked by NATO jets from Italy, which is on rotation up there in Estonia. And also Finland and Sweden scrambled their own jets out of a national concern. So they were also in the air. But these planes certainly just didn't try to hurry back out of Estonian airspace. And they were also armed, Kate. They were armed with missiles. So Estonia was very worried. The Estonian government called a meeting of the United Nations Security Council immediately. They also called a meeting of NATO under Article 4, which is a formal grouping, meaning that they feel that their territorial integrity or their political independence is at threat. And the Estonian foreign minister there in New York brought photos and radar diagrams of exactly where the planes were to prove this, because the Russians say that this didn't happen at all. So, you know, that's typical, but it certainly upped the ante a lot. And now we're talking about much more robust responses to this, like, should they be shot down? And that's a really big question.
And if that happens, Terry, what then? I mean, is that World War III?
That's the question. And there is a serious question now about whether these jets should be shot down in such egregious cases to show Moscow that you cannot intrude on our airspace, and especially not with, you know, armed jets. You can't pretend it was an accident, and you can't pretend it was innocent. So this is really a big discussion now in NATO. And in fact, after this Article 4 meeting that I mentioned, Secretary General Rutte came out and held a press conference so that he could come out and, I think, try to calm down some of the jangled nerves, not just because the incursion happened, but because of what Poland said it's going to do. So I think there's not a united position on whether planes should be shot down by any means. But late Tuesday at the UN, President Trump, and you never know how he's going to go on these things, he was asked, should NATO countries shoot down Russian planes if they go into their airspace? And he had a three-word answer, Kate. He said, yeah. Oh, he was asked if he supported that, and he said, yes, I do. And I don't think anybody expected that. So then, of course, NATO countries who would be in favor of this feel very much strengthened by having the United States supporting that stance. So we really don't know how this is going to play out.
And meanwhile, of course, the issue of drones carries on. Airport chaos this week, Terry. Is that connected?
Yeah, that's right. In Denmark, huge drones were spotted over Copenhagen, so much so that the airport was closed for several hours. There was a similar incident in Oslo at the same time. And at this point, at the time we're recording this, the Danish government doesn't know who sent those drones. It doesn't know where they came from. It decided not to shoot them down because it was in a heavily populated area. And the police said that shooting something down over an airport where you have a lot of fuel stored and, you know, planes with full tanks, that would be very dangerous. A lot of people around there. So we don't know yet. They certainly are casting suspicion on Russia because they described these drones as being so sophisticated and having a particular flight path that made them think that it's what they called a capable actor, which is sort of almost a state actor, the term that they would use for a government. Yeah, this just highlighted again that these unmanned vehicles can cause a lot of problem, can cause a lot of chaos, can cause a lot of fear on the ground, and that governments really need to come up with a decision-making framework for what they're going to do. It just reminds us how high-tech weapons, as we've seen in the war in Ukraine, really seem to be the future of war fighting. And even when they're not fighting, they can cause a lot of disruption and concern.
Terry Schultz, thank you very much for watching the skies for us.
Thank you, Kate. Thanks for having me.
Inside Europe's security correspondent, Terry Schultz there. Not long after we recorded that interview, Denmark's Aalborg Airport was closed for hours due to drones in its airspace. There were also concerns over their presence in at least three other locations, including near military bases. For the latest, follow Terry on socials. You're listening to Inside Europe. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. Moldova is a small, landlocked country bordering Ukraine and Romania with a population of around 2.4 million people. This Sunday, 28th of September, Moldova goes to the polls in what may very well be the most important election since it emerged as an independent republic following the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991. The choice? Russia versus the EU. Democracy versus authoritarianism. Dana Scherler, head of DW's Romanian service, is part of the team covering the elections. She spoke to me on Thursday morning from her hotel room in the capital, Chisinau. She began by telling me that, in a way, the very fact that elections are taking place at all is something of a miracle.
Yes, because many of my Moldovan colleagues and friends were afraid that at this point in this year, Moldova would not be a free democratic country anymore. So when the war in Ukraine started in 2022, many of us were afraid that Moldova would be under Russian occupation just a few days after the beginning of the full-scale invasion of Ukraine, because back then, of course, also, many experts and journalists were afraid that Ukraine was not going to make it to resist for a long time. And then Moldova would be next.
The elections are happening, but they're happening against a background of intense concern, nationally and internationally, about Russian interference. You on the ground, what are you seeing? What are you hearing?
The atmosphere is very tense. A lot of people we talked about are really afraid about what might happen after Sunday. We talked, for example, to young people who have very small kids and who said that they were ready to leave the country in case the pro-Russian bloc wins the election.
Wow. Okay. But I think we've established that for Moldova, the stakes could not be higher. Internationally, however, the stakes are also extremely high.
Yes, they definitely are. And a possible success of pro-Russian forces, of a pro-Russian electoral bloc in the Republic of Moldova, would also affect Ukraine as a neighboring country. And Moldova's Prime Minister, Dorin Recean, warned, for example, that Russia also needs the airport in Chisinau, in the capital of Moldova, to increase its illegal military presence in Transnistria, in the separatist republic, from about 1,500 troops that they have now to maybe even 10,000 troops. And this could be a direct threat to Odessa, that is very, very close to Transnistria. And also, several former U.S. ambassadors to Moldova wrote an open letter to Moldovans this week, published it this week before the elections. And in this letter, they also warned that there is no middle ground between freedom and tyranny, and that a victory of pro-Russian forces would also affect the security of the whole region and the security of NATO's eastern flank. So the implications are really huge. It's not about one small country, one small Soviet republic. It's about the whole region and also about the war in Ukraine.
So a real sense of an existential turning point. And of course, there have been really alarming headlines in recent days about apparent attempts by Russia to sabotage, in fact, the elections. Perhaps you could just unpack that for me a little bit.
Well, the Russian interference has many different layers. One very obvious layer is propaganda and fake news. So, for example, a journalist from Ziarul de Gardă, a very good investigative newspaper that we also collaborate with as DW Romanian, the Romanian service, has managed to make an investigation on this fake news, on a whole scheme of spreading fake news and manipulation on social media. So a journalist from this newspaper managed to infiltrate such a network and uncover the way that people were being paid from Russia to post on TikTok and Facebook, for example, fakes about the pro-European president Maya Sandu, fakes about the pro-European government, the current government. And these fakes were sometimes really crazy and horrifying. I mean, even false allegations such as President Maya Sandu supporting child trafficking and things like that.
Have you spoken to anyone who would like to see closer ties with Russia?
On the one hand, you have elderly people who are sometimes nostalgic about the Soviet Union, who regret the end of the Soviet Union. And some people are also not necessarily pro-Russian, but anti-European, because they believe the lies of the pro-Russian propaganda. So lies such as the idea that European integration would somehow pull Moldova into the war.
If you could pick one moment, one sort of overriding impression or encounter that has stuck out for you since you arrived, what would it be?
It would be the war veteran who is in his 70s from the Transnistrian war, who talked about Europe in such positive terms, because his children live in Western Europe and have a better life there. And he also traveled to Western Europe to visit his children and his grandchildren. And his way of being cautiously optimistic and saying that, yes, on the one hand, he had a very difficult life, but at the same time, he still hopes for the best in the future.
Well, I think cautious optimism is very much a note that I would like to end on. So I'm going to thank you very, very much for now, Dana. We will be linking to your team's excellent coverage in our show notes. And I am really looking forward to welcoming you to the Inside Europe studio next week, where we will be able to discuss the results.
Thank you so much. I'm looking forward to it too.
Dana Scherler is head of DW's Romanian service. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. Welcome back to Inside Europe, the weekly current affairs podcast and radio programme from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. I'm Kate Laycock in Bonn. One of the most dramatic developments in the run-up to Sunday's all-important elections in Moldova has been a series of raids resulting in the arrest of 74 people, all allegedly part of a Russian-backed plan to incite mass riots and destabilise the country ahead of the vote. Perhaps most disturbingly, the Moldovan authorities alleged that the majority of these people had attended Russian training camps in Serbia. To find out more about the Serbia connection, I spoke to our Balkans correspondent, Guy Delaunay.
So it's not the first time, actually, that we've heard about the Serbia connection. We've had this come up before, that there's supposed to have been agitators who've been trained, not just in Serbia, but in Bosnia as well, which is, of course, neighbouring to Serbia and of course, has a large region which is majority Serb within it. And the prosecutor in this case has said that most of the suspects that they've arrested, these 74 people, systematically travelled to Serbia where they received training. And this is training in things like, you know, how to stage a riot, how to provoke civil disturbances, how to even place graffiti around the place which would stir up trouble somehow within Moldova. And we've had the head of Moldova's police also saying that some of the suspects who went to Serbia, to these camps, didn't actually know what the real purpose of the trips were. And previously we've heard that people have been recruited through paintball tournaments, for example. And then they were somehow dragged into these operations, and even some of them were saying that being told that they were making pilgrimages to Orthodox Christian sites within Serbia. And only later did they find out that there was something going on in terms of having these camps for stirring up mischief in Moldova. So there's a lot of detail that's yet to come out of this, and one would suspect that more of the details will emerge if Moldova does indeed proceed with these prosecutions.
And I mean, potentially this is incredibly explosive, because let's not forget that Serbia still has officially at least EU candidate status. What kind of indications do we have that the Serbian authorities might have been aware of these alleged camps, and how credible are these claims?
The big issue for Serbia has been for a long time now, which camp is it in? And I'm not talking about these Moldovan mischief camps here either. Is it in Russia's camp or is it in the European Union's camp? Now, officially, Serbia is deep into EU accession negotiations, and it started these a dozen years ago. And every time you hear President Aleksandar Vučić speak, he always talks about Serbia's EU path and its path towards membership of the European Union. At the same time, he says that Serbia has every right to maintain friendly relations with its traditional allies. And this, of course, includes Russia. And we've seen this throughout the war in Ukraine, that Serbia has not imposed the same sort of sanctions that EU countries have done, even though as an EU candidate country and deep into negotiations, it's supposed to be harmonising its foreign policy with that of the European Union. And there's always a question there about the degree to which Moscow is using this friendly relationship with Serbia to make mischief in the Balkans and the surrounding area, which of course takes in Moldova. And Vuk Vuksanović is from the Belgrade Center for Security Policy. He's the author of a book called Serbia's Balancing Act Between Russia and the West. And he told me that assessing the credibility of Moldova's claims is not exactly straightforward.
On one hand, it is quite possible that some assistance was given to the Russians. It's possible, it should not be discounted. But at the same time, we also have to be mindful of this fact as well, that frequently the elites in Eastern Europe and the Balkans inflate the Russian threat in order to elicit support from the West. It is possible, absolutely, it should not be eliminated under any circumstances. But I think that a more thorough investigation would definitely be needed.
What would be in it for Russia to do the camps in Serbia?
I think perhaps a little bit something of a logistical ease of doing it in a country which is in some form of geopolitical gray zone. I think that would probably be the only remaining asset that Russians could have in something of this sort.
Finally, Guy, I am aware, of course, that your expert, Vuk Vuksanovic, warned that assessing the credibility of Moldova's claims is not straightforward. However, with that caveat in place, should it really turn out that there are Russian training camps being run in Serbia and Bosnia on the scale that Moldova is claiming, what does that mean for the Balkans region and for the stability, you know, of an area where the peace is always fragile?
We've seen Russian interference in the region on a regular basis over the past decade. It tried to scupper Montenegro joining NATO. There were some indications the authorities in Montenegro claimed that Russia was behind a supposed coup attempt. And again, that's complicated. There's large degrees of plausible deniability that come into play. But there are indications that at least some Russian actors were in effect in Montenegro. We've seen it as well in North Macedonia before North Macedonia itself became a member of NATO. We've seen these allegations of camps being staged in Bosnia as well as Serbia. Plus, we've got this very close relationship between the Bosnian Serb leader, Milorad Dodik, and Russia. He's constantly boasting about his close relationship with Vladimir Putin and popping up in Moscow to try and show how close he is to the authorities there. All of these things give Moscow the ability, at a very low cost to itself, to make mischief in the region and to make not just those countries themselves concerned, but also the West as well. Everybody's well aware that things have heated up in the Balkans in the past. The things have been calm now for a couple of decades in this region. But everybody's aware there is always the potential for things to be stirred up again in several places in the Western Balkans. And just by stirring up that fear that there could be fresh conflict or fresh trouble in the region, Moscow is keeping Western attention, at least to some extent, distracted by what might happen in the Western Balkans, because it wants to distract from what it's doing in places like Ukraine and Moldova.
Guy Delaunay, thank you very much for talking to me.
It's a pleasure.
Our Balkans correspondent, Guy Delaunay, there. Just as we were going to studio this week, Inside Europe's producer, Laura Kabelka, received a phone call. It was from Yasemin Adjar, a German activist aboard one of the boats attempting to break Israel's blockade of Gaza and deliver much-needed humanitarian relief directly to the Palestinians trapped there. She gave this account of an incident late on Tuesday night when the flotilla was attacked by drones. No passengers were injured.
While we were sailing in international waters, but close to Greece, we detected drones. I was doing the night watch because I'm responsible for the security, and I've seen 15 big drones. Usually, we are used to these small drones because these ones were quite big, quite low. And they were surveilling us. And then at some point, when we joined the fleet, we had like 30 minutes complete silence, no drones. And then suddenly, I think it was very, very shocking. The international waters that we were in became a battlefield, like thing. Bombs raining down on us, 11 bombs back to back on 11 different vessels, trying to start a fire, damage the sails, which they did. And it was horrific because it was very loud, the bombs. And obviously, our first thought was, you know, this is just a small fraction of what Gaza is going through. And we know that. And because we know that, we decided that we will continue.
German activist Yasemin Adjar there, speaking from on board one of the boats that make up the global Samud flotilla. Accounts of the exact number of drones involved in the attack vary. Italy dispatched a naval frigate to the flotilla's aid, and Spain has announced its intention to do the same. On Wednesday, the Israeli Foreign Ministry repeated an invitation for the flotilla to drop humanitarian aid in an Israeli port, leaving it to Israeli authorities to take it on to Gaza or face consequences. To the UK now, where it is party conference season. That is when the major political parties hold their annual gatherings, and this year's takes place with Britain's politics seemingly in flux. The governing Labour Party has a large majority in Parliament after last year's general election, but has been slumping in national polling. The UK's summer has also seen a series of protests and tensions over migration. and the right-wing nationalist Reform UK party, led by Nigel Farage, is positioning itself as a genuine contender to lead the next government. Ollie Barrett reports from London.
A marching band heralds the opening of the Liberal Democrats party conference in Bournemouth. They used it to say patriotism can be positive and unifying at the end of a summer when there have been tensions and divisions on display.
We risk becoming an island of strangers, not a nation that walks forward together.
Weeks earlier, Prime Minister Keir Starmer made these controversial comments he later apologised for, insisting he hadn't realised they echoed infamous remarks made in 1968 by former MP Enoch Powell, which have long been viewed by many as xenophobic. But the Prime Minister's speech on immigration in May came because he knows it's a key concern for many voters.
So yes, I believe in this. I believe we need to reduce immigration significantly.
And this is a Prime Minister that knows he has to respond to voters' concerns and fast, because his Labour Party has been behind the Reform UK party of Nigel Farage in the polls for months. And Keir Starmer's domestic ratings have fallen rapidly since winning July 2024's election. A recent poll by YouGov found just 22% of Britons have a favourable opinion of him. Polling expert Professor John Curtis says the government needs to improve its communication strategy.
The key question, of course, that lies behind all of the government's difficulties during the summer is what is it that the Prime Minister wishes to convey to the public, particularly above all, what is it that the Prime Minister has to say when asked, what do you stand for? What kind of country do you want to create?
And in that vacuum, Professor Curtis says, exists a political insurgent.
I'm an insomniac. I'm an insomniac.
That's Andrea Jenkins, Reform UK's Mayor of Greater Lincolnshire at the party conference earlier this month, singing a song she wrote called Insomniac. And she insists Reform is keeping the Labour Party up at night. Reform is also regularly polling higher than the official current opposition, the Conservative Party, which was in power from 2010 to 2024 and now faces an existential threat. Former Brexit campaigner Nigel Farage set up Reform, and a huge focus for it is immigration.
You will find it has actually been, in productive terms, a disaster for this country. So how many firms that could have prospered haven't? How many have gone bust that shouldn't have done? It's led to a change of culture that has been ruinous.
Critics of Reform say their rhetoric around migration has contributed to community tensions. On the 13th of September, a so-called Unite the Kingdom rally in London, organised by Tommy Robinson, considered by most mainstream politicians to be a far-right activist, gathered tens of thousands of people. One of the speakers at the protest, billionaire Elon Musk.
This is a message to the reasonable centre, the people who ordinarily wouldn't get involved in politics. If this continues, that violence is going to come to you. You will have no choice. Whether you choose violence or not, violence is coming to you. You either fight back or you die.
It was a day that did see outbreaks of violence and several police officers were injured. Not far away, a so-called Unite Against Fascism counter-protest attended by Labour MP Diane Abbott.
It's important because we're seeing a rise in racist violence.
But Cabinet Minister Peter Kyle says the government understands some of the issues that brought people out to Tommy Robinson's demonstration.
Some of those people were there raising very legitimate issues for which this government feels the urgency when it comes to things like small boats and migration and asylum.
And the government was also reluctant to criticise a summer grassroots movement that saw English and British flags hung from buildings, bridges and lampposts across the country. But Prime Minister Keir Starmer did issue a statement condemning people who, in his words, exploit the English flag to whip up hatred. Union boss Paul Novak told the Trades Union conference he took a stronger view.
Patriotism is never about daubing graffiti on people's homes or shops or intimidating our friends and neighbours.
The Labour Party believes it can reduce tensions around some of these issues by bringing overall net migration and illegal immigration numbers down. And it also hopes that if it can encourage more economic growth in the UK, that will also contribute to lower concerns around immigration and see the government grow in popularity again and at least have a chance of winning the next general election due in about 4 years. Energy Secretary Ed Miliband believes Keir Starmer is capable of that.
What matters in politics is you go through these periods of turbulence is that you stay focused on the mission. And Keir knows exactly what he's about, which is making this country better for working people.
But Scarlett Maguire from polling organisation JL Partners says the Prime Minister is under pressure heading into his own party conference this weekend.
We've seen from former prime ministers that once you get to the sorts of negativity he's seeing in the polls at the moment, it becomes quite hard things to turn around. This is where it's particularly interesting for Keir Starmer. When you ask people what the Labour Party stands for, they actually have a pretty decent sense of what they think it means. When you ask for Keir Starmer, people increasingly see they don't know.
If Keir Starmer can't change that, British politics may change forever. Ollie Barrett, DW, London.
If ever there were a time to learn lessons from the past, it's now. But 80 years since the end of the Second World War, memories are fading, even in the places most shaped by its events, like the Czech town of Česká Kamenice, in what was once the German Sudetenland. Rob Cameron reports on a unique educational project bringing together schoolchildren from both the Czech and German side of today's border.
In the upstairs room of Česká Kamenice's House of Culture, a dozen secondary school students are seated around a table, listening to an old man's stories. Oswald Kittel is 96, and to say the 20th century was not kind to him is something of an understatement. Born in this town in 1929, Oswald came from a German-speaking family in what was a German-speaking town in a German-speaking region, Czechoslovakia's Sudetenland. Then came Hitler, and everything changed. The stories are confusing and contradictory, a reflection of the era. Oswald's Sudeten German father remained loyal to Czechoslovakia and heeded the call to enlist in September 1938 and was subsequently treated as a traitor by his neighbours when the Sudetenland was annexed by Nazi Germany.
In peace, Hitler has achieved his objects. A peace preserved by Mr.
But Oswald admits that a month later, he and his fellow pupils enthusiastically welcomed Hitler as a liberator when he drove through Česká Kamenice.
Meanwhile, in peace, the Germans enter Sudetenland. The barrier is raised and the cars drive in. How different is entry?
And describes his own enlistment into the Wehrmacht as a teenager in the dying weeks of the war. And then the moment in May 1945 when, trying to sneak back into Česká Kamenice to collect food from his aunts and grandmother, he realised the Czechoslovak official firing his rifle at him was the local milkman he'd known well before the war. At that point, he knew he would have to flee his hometown for good, and indeed he and his family were expelled under the Beneš decrees and became refugees in Germany. Oswald told me afterwards he simply recounts to the teenagers a mix of students from the English College in Prague, a local gymnasium in Česká Kamenice, and a school in Sebnitz across the border in Germany, the truth about what happened.
I think this project has certainly been very, very successful, and I've received many thanks from the director of the English College. But the most important thing for me is definitely the fact that the truth has been written, that it's been recorded somewhere so that people know how it truly happened. And it's also a kind of confirmation of all the work that I've been doing in the last 30 years.
Did you really believe the German propaganda?
The students seated around the table with him have honest, unvarnished questions. Could you not have simply refused to join the Wehrmacht, they ask. No. It's hard for you to understand, he said, but you would have been shot. Among the group were 16-year-olds Philip Thorne and Adam Gold from the English College in Prague.
Well, I still see in many older Czechs, including people in my family, that they still have a small hatred of the Germans, even though they've contributed to the Czech Republic's wealth so much. And I think that if this was talked about more, and if the Czechs would realize that they were the bad guys, which the Czechs don't realize much in history, I think that this sort of idea of Germans being bad, Germans will invade us again, will be gone. I would say that in Czech schools especially, it isn't talked about as much as it should probably be talked about. I feel like there should be a change to integrate maybe more educational, maybe this documentary that we watched, these seminars that we did, or even just learning about it more.
The project began 8 years ago as a modest school trip to the area run by Alena Shvedova, a teacher at the English college who happened to have a country cottage nearby. She told me more about her motivation for doing it.
I think that this land is sort of ill, I would say, and needs healing. And it is ill because there were so many cruel, bad things happening during the war and also after the war. And when the Germans who were coming here, former Sudetenland Germans, once after one visit, after talking to our students who were really interested in their life stories, and they were able to tell them all the all what they went through, all their regrets, etc., and sorrows, then they told me, now we can die. And this was for me enormous reward.
Oswald Kittel may be hale and hearty with vivid memories, but he is still 96. Soon there will be no more survivors left. That's why what began as a school trip is gradually becoming something more permanent. There are plans for an educational centre recording the memories of people like Oswald Kittel and so many others for future generations. For DW, this is Rob Cameron in Česká Kamenice.
If you'd like to send us feedback on that or any other report that you've heard in the show, then our address is insideeurope@dw.com. Finally, something cheesy. Literally cheesy, because our unofficial culinary correspondent Danny Mitzman spent last weekend at the biannual cheese festival in the northwest Italian hill town of Bra. The four-day event, which ended on Monday, is the largest in the world dedicated to raw milk cheeses and is organised by the slow food movement.
The slow food movement began in the 1980s as a reaction to the growth of fast food in Italy. It's since become an international champion of good, clean, fair food and traditional production methods. Bra is where it all began, and its headquarters remain almost 40 years on.
My name is Francesco Sottile, and I'm a member of the board of directors in Slow Food International. We started 30 years ago talking about cheese because we thought that cheese is a tool to put in evidence how important is the biodiversity in the sector of farming traditional breeds and producing traditional cheeses.
Every cheese has a theme, and this edition's was a world around it. The focus was on agroecology, how to create a better future for cheesemakers, shepherds, farmers, and the animals and land they safeguard. At the House of Biodiversity, there were no free seats at the back-to-back conferences. Subjects covered everything from protecting native breeds and alpine landscapes to uses for surplus wool and courses for shepherds.
Walking up the streets of Bra, which is a small hill town, you have to fight the crowds to get to the stands. there is so much enthusiasm. People from all over Italy and other countries have come to this four-day cheesy extravaganza.
Of course, the main attraction for most of us is the cheese itself. Slow Food has a system of presidia, foods judged to be at risk and in need of a protective spotlight. There are now over 100 dairy presidia, more than any other type of food, and there's an entire street here dedicated to them. As a Brit living in Italy, no prizes for guessing my first stop.
Traditional cheddar makers use these really big forks to mix in the salt and cool down the curds. So it just seemed like a big instrument that was identified with traditional cheddar.
Morgan Trethowan's been making his pitchfork cheddar since 2017 and is the newest producer to join the artisanal Somerset Cheddar Presidium.
I really like Slow Food. I like what it stands for. And I like the fact that us cheddar makers come together to work together at the event. They're all 15 months. We made that decision to bring the same aged cheese to give people that comparison then to see how different it can be.
This year, there are three new cheese presidia from Italy, Austria and France. Claude Mendler, who's come from Strasbourg in Alsace, is standing in front of a giant photo of beautiful grazing cows.
La Vosgienne, a typical cow which has been settled down 600 years back in Alsatia, which is appropriate for small mountains, out of which only remain about 10,000 cows.
By creating a presidium connected to the breed, the aim is to protect the farmers who still practice transhumance and the biodiversity of the mountain meadows where the cows graze, giving the milk, thus the cheeses, both quality and flavour.
In the past, the cheeses in Alsace were only made out of this milk, the milk of those cows. And the traditional cheese is Munster cheese, which exists since more than 500 years. And this cheese is now made mainly industrially. Let us say that about 90% of the Munster you can purchase is industrial, as of Camembert, as of Feta, as of Gouda. All those cheeses which are very popular have become industrialized. So we wanted to promote producers which make the cheese only with that milk on a traditional way in the fields in summer, in the winter with hay, and who use also traditional ferments. This is the aim, everything traditional.
After Presidia Street, I'm off to the cheese maturer stands in Affiner Alley to meet Sarah Stewart, the managing director of Neal's Yard Dairy in London. Sarah's been coming to cheese for over 20 years and supports Slow Food's decision to make the event exclusively for raw milk cheeses, despite divided public opinion about how safe they are to eat.
It's much harder for people to produce raw milk cheese, the bureaucracy and there really is a threat to raw milk cheese continuing to be produced, and for Slow Food to really back that and put a sort of a line in the sand as to this is what we feel is important is super important for us. And also, you know, taking that choice away from the individual seems very unfair, so having a festival that highlights the value of raw milk is pretty incredible.
Danny Mitzman for DW in Bra.
Time for us to go before this programme starts to stink like an overly mature camembert. Our producer this week was Lara Kabelka. Our sound engineer was Michel Springer. I'm Kate Laycock, and Inside Europe comes to you from DW in Bonn, Germany.